Good evening, James McCanny here, January 5th, 2012, first show of 2012. Excellent. We are now in 2012. So all of the hype, all of the people riding the wave, so to speak, and of course what I've said all along is that's just a myth. There are more myths about this year than there are about anything else. The hype has been incredible, and when you start seeing this on the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, and other places like that promoting it, that would normally promote standard science, you realize that this 2012 issue is being promoted by a large, well-funded government disinformation program, which has been going for a long time, many years. This probably started at least 6 years ago, and the seeds of this probably started before that. And so at first it came out and it was just like, a couple researchers, a couple guys sitting in grandma's basement dreaming this up. But no, this was a well-crafted, right from the very beginning, disinformation program, and here we are now in 2012. This is my first show of 2012, and right out of the chute, the disinformation people are just pouring it on full speed. But anyway, their main science topics I will talk tonight. Some really good listener questions came in over the past week. One of them, I'll talk about a comet Hale-Bopp versus the comet Lovejoy that came through the solar system, passed through the solar atmosphere on December 15th, and then came out the other side as a minor planet, showing that the nucleus all along had been a pretty good-sized planet, probably bigger than the planet Mercury, which is a decent-sized object, and then formed a comet again, just proving without a doubt that this idea that these are little icy wanderers is absolutely absurd. But the question I want to address tonight, question by a listener, is that, okay, let's compare this to Hale-Bopp. Comet Lovejoy was the biggest comet to get into the inner solar system in history ever observed, and there have been some big, big ones. So let's compare it to comet Hale-Bopp back in the mid-90s, which lasted for about 6 years in the sky. Now, 6 years is a huge amount of time for any comet. Most comets are visible or in the sense of readily visible from Earthlings, from Earth, and with moderate equipment, or visible to the naked eye. Typically, comets are visible only for a couple of days. Maybe a week would be a long comet, but 6 years? Comet Hale-Bopp just won the prize hands down for the longest comet in history in modern times. But of course, Venus, the comet in history we know from the ancients, was in the solar system probably for a period of about 600 years. It dominated the sky. And then here comes comet Lovejoy, and it, by the way, comet Venus, before it became the planet Venus, was much, much bigger. From the reports we have of the ancients, the comet Venus stretched across the sky, had as many as 7 different tails, and was visible in the daytime. It simply dominated the sky at certain times, and the ancients watched this with great admiration and respect, because it actually encountered Earth on 2 occasions, and apparently the second encounter just took Earth to the cleaners, sent us back to the ice age, back to the cave ages, and that's why you have civilizations all around the world that are disjoint, disconnected, and around as society developed, either by land or by ocean, they started discovering these other lands that had been there and populations had been there for a very long time. So at any rate, comet Venus would certainly rank as the biggest comet in recorded history, but in modern history, modern times, Hale Bopp certainly holds the candle, I think, for the largest comet. But the question is about the time that they were visible. Comet Hale Bopp for 6 years, Comet Lovejoy for about 2 days before it zipped back out of the solar system and went flying back out of here and simply not visible anymore to the average person. Good equipment, you could still see Comet Lovejoy, but what's the difference? Anyway, that'll be one of the main science topics. The other one, a listener wrote in from England and asked about the three-blade wind generator system, which is something I talk about regularly, how inefficient they are. I did a special one night, a full-length show on Coast to Coast AM with host George Noy, and I called the topic of the show was the myth of alternative energy. One of the central points, I talked about many different types of alternative energy, solar heating, the Carnot cycle used to heat engines using solar power, the state of solar cells, things like that. These industries are very well controlled by the what some people might call the powers that be, because energy is one of the big controlling factors of the world. The whole world is dependent on energy. The war in Iran, all of the conflict with Iran, is about Iran developing peaceful power for nuclear. There's been a lot of hype lately because Iran has finally done some basic tests of core rods, and these are the essential fuel elements that are used, and then there's a number of different aspects of developing peaceful power for nuclear power. But here's the thing. Imagine General Electric and all of the other major companies that contribute have a monopoly worldwide on nuclear energy, that install nuclear power plants around the world. They really don't want some third world country developing nuclear power and putting it online and being able to sell it in the third world, where the United States is not exactly welcome. You know, the U.S. companies, even though these companies like GE are international and subject to no one's rules, the situation is they control all of these minor aspects of energy, such as alternative energy. So they have allowed the three-blade wind system and solar systems to exist, and that simply gives the tree huggers, who are very easily fooled many times, it gives them the illusion that something is going on. What I pointed out on the Coast to Coast show is that to use wind energy the way it is today with the three-blade system, a tremendously inefficient system, and with many, many technical problems. For example, it cannot work at high wind speeds. It cannot work at wind speeds where the wind up high on the wind tower is more than the wind down below, because it starts stressing on the gimbals that hold the blades in place, because you get more pressure at the top than at the bottom. There's a long laundry list of problems with that three-blade system. But the question from the listener was, given the three-blade system and the fact that it's pretty useless and worthless, what is a decent, and because I've made the comment too, that wind energy is the solution. Just a quick comment, going back to the three-blade system, I showed that with simple numbers, simple math, you can show that the three-blade systems, you would need 77 million of these three-blade systems around the world to sustain our energy needs, and it would only happen at peak wind at all of these stations all the time. And that would assume that you have constant wind, that the wind doesn't vary and go down to zero, which it does a lot of times. There are places around the world that have good wind part of the year, but not all of the year. So the main point is that wind energy is and can be a great contributor, but given the three-blade system, I said that system was designed a designed flaw going into this, allowing people to and governments to pass laws and zoning so that these systems could go in, but they had no hope of ever really producing energy on the scale we need, which provides the myth of alternative energy. It just keeps the greeny tree huggers happy and thinking that every time they see a windmill, our life is going to get better, when the people on top, the people in the energy industry, know for an absolute fact that wind power, the way that it is designed and implemented today, will not work. So at any rate, the listener question is, what kind of a system is legitimate? What kind of a wind system could work? Okay, so that's question number two. And then I've got some other points. By the way, we had another comet come into the solar system this past week. January 2nd, I announced another comet coming into the solar system last week. Last week on my show, there was another comet prior to that coming into the solar system, all from the south, all coming on that same path as Comet Lovejoy. Anyway, a few topics to get into there tonight. I want to just take a few minutes here at the beginning of the show to talk about health topics. And, of course, I have put my personal concentration on water, clean water. It's just horrific what is in the water today. All the chemicals, all of the solvents, the drugs, the pharmaceutical drugs that people take, it goes into the water system. It works its way down and eventually goes into the water table, where it stays, and then it comes up into the city water, into the tanks, and then out into your home through your faucet. So what do people do with this tremendous problem of pollution of water? It's just everywhere. It's in the water tables, and it's going to be in your water. What do you do about this? And then to boot, one of the big problems today is plastic water bottles. Those plastic water bottles that are clear, especially, are the worst ones. They're not recyclable. And also they have chemicals in them. If they're in the sun or if they're frozen or get cold, that water leaches out of, or the chemicals leach out of the plastic bottle into the water, and people are drinking this chemical slew, thinking that they're getting fresh French, and they have all kinds of fancy names. You see them in the grocery shelf store. But a lot of cases, this water simply comes from ground surface natural sources. There's a company that has a right to go into Lake Superior and bottle water directly out of the lake, and they put a fancy label on it and sell it to you for an outrageous price per bottle of water. But then the bottle gets thrown away. It's not recyclable. And I put on my sales page, go take a look at it if you haven't been there, but I happen to be at a tropical beach. It's a very good picture of a beach, and it shows bottles. The whole beach for miles and miles is just covered, literally covered, with washed up plastic bottles that have come from all over the world. So just the ocean is littered with these plastic bottles that go down rivers, float around until they find a home on a beach or whatever, and there they are. Literally covered for everything from milk bottles to those plastic water bottles that you buy at the store, the convenience store. And what a pollution mess this world has had. In every day, millions and millions more of those plastic bottles are made, filled with water, and people are drinking basically the solvents that are in that plastic, the chemical solvents that are carcinogenic, that can cause cancer, are in the plastic bottles. And people are drinking this in mass all over the world, thinking they're drinking healthy water. And especially people who are health-minded. They're, I'm drinking this pure mountain spring water. And they're drinking chemicals very harsh chemicals that will cause cancer. So my emphasis has been on have your own water system, have your own storage system for water, and that's why the stainless steel water bottles are on my webpage. And at all of these things at amazingly good prices. So I'm not going to say much more about that, but just water is so important. Recently there was a conference, and I talked about this a few weeks ago, but I didn't have time to really get into it. This took place in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in last August, 2011. It was called the International Conference on Atmospheric Electricity, the 14th year. And so if they've been having this in meeting in Standard Science for 14 years, my work predates that by a good couple of decades. But at any rate, I just want to give you an idea of the lack of progress in this field in Standard Science. The meeting, one of the main thrusts of the meeting was talking about fair weather electricity, thunderstorm electrification, and lightning. They still don't know where lightning comes from. And so anyway, one of the main keynote speakers talked about the concept that they are still proponing that lightning is caused in electricity in clouds, is called in thunderstorms, the electric field in thunderstorms and thunder clouds is caused by a mechanism of ice-ice collision. So what they're saying is that little ice droplets collide and cause electric fields. How this supposedly happens, to me, is just beyond bizarre. It is absolutely bizarre, just fairy tale science. And then, even if you could get a vertical electric field from ice particles colliding, then how do you get the lightning to shoot out of your battery? On both sides, it shoots up the top out of the battery where you can see X-rays, even up to gamma rays, sometimes out of the vertical side of the thunderstorm systems, you can see gamma ray activity and X-rays above the thunderclouds, and then you have lightning coming out of the thunderclouds below down to Earth. How does this happen? I mean, it's a self-contained system, and in any electrical system, it would quickly, especially in a cloud, be shielded by electric, by ionization and the movement of ions to shield it, and nothing, you wouldn't see any effect outside of the clouds. Another very blatant example of electricity that has to come from outside the planet, by the way, that's what I've said all along, the electric fields are driven by outer space, the conditions in outer space around planet Earth. And my weather book, all of my books talk about this and how it actually works, but just here we are in the year 2011 and now 2012, atmospheric scientists worldwide are still talking about little ice particles colliding together in ice in thunderstorm clouds to create electric fields. Absolute fairy tale science. Just unbelievable. So at any rate, that's the current state of Standard Science. And let me just put a note on this, because 512. So when I do these articles, comment on these articles, I always put a date on them to indicate which show I talked about, so I can go back and look at my commentary, etc. And that's one thing, by the way, for those of you who look at my archive page and listen to my archives. Some people say, why don't you list all of the things you talk about on the show? And then they could go and pick and choose what topics they want to listen to. And there's some very good reasons why I do not do that. Because, number one, people would not listen to the whole show and get the whole message. Some people would go in and say, well, at minute 14, he talks about this topic, and I just want to listen to that. Well, that's not the way this works. You have to listen to the whole thing. And secondly, the naysayers, they have to listen to my whole show too. They can't just go in and pick out a little part here or there or whatever. So I don't list my topics, and that forces people to go listen to the entire show, and it makes them listen to the entire show. And that's the message. I mean, the message is very complete and complicated. You can't understand part of this without understanding the whole picture, including misinformation and all of the other things that are going on out there. Just another comment in talking, this is going back to water, just a few things additional about water and water systems and emergency systems in general. The general rule is that if it has an electric cord or some kind of a connection, like a water tube, any kind of connection, especially electric cord, it is not emergency. I get a kick out of some people had been advertising emergency systems that you plug in. Well, where are you going to plug this into in a case of emergency, or how is it portable? All of that extra equipment to run the electric, it weighs something. You have to carry this around, and when you get to where you're going, what are you going to plug it into? Are you going to carry your generator and then 10 gallons of gasoline, and then it only works until your 10 gallons of gasoline runs out? No, it's not emergency. You need something that's totally portable. And the other thing about water, I was in talking to a fan one day on the phone. We were talking about water, and this person had purchased some water filter products. And so we were talking about that, and I said, yeah, you know, you got to get your water together first. If there's an emergency, the very first thing out of the chute that you do is you make sure you have your water system set up and operational. Excuse me. You have your water system. If there's a source of fresh water, start filling up containers. And there's one thing, too, that's very, very, very important. And I guess you could talk to Moses about this. You could talk to the ancient Maya about this, that you need your water in closed containers. If you have water stored up, you need it in closed containers. Filling up the bathtub or other containers like that would be fine, but if you're dealing with pollution in the air, which there many times would be in case of emergency, then you that water that's just sitting in your bathtub is going to become polluted. Well, it's better than nothing. I would fill up my bathtub too. If there was water available and there was an emergency, I'd fill up the bathtub and I'd fill up any container I had handy. But then that's, by the way, why I put on the market this new water filtration and storage system. So you can have very good containers with a sealed, airtight sealed cap on them. Then you can store your water and you can store as much as you want. But anyway, the point is that having storage containers that are sealable, that are sealed, and there's no air, dust, or powder, or whatever that's going to get in there, so you have your water in a safe place. Water is very difficult to move around. It's very heavy. If you don't believe me, get a couple of 5-gallon containers sometime, fill them up with water, and try and walk up and down the block with them for a while. See how easy water is to move. It's very difficult. Or if you put some in your car, you might get 100 gallons in your car, but it builds up a lot of weight very quickly. I think a gallon of water weighs 6 pounds. And so, say you have a 5-gallon bucket, what's that? You're pushing 30 pounds per bucket, and then they're not very easy to handle either, because water has volume. And so trying to carry a couple of 5-gallon buckets around is not easy. So the easiest thing to carry around is a water filter. But at any rate, an empty water filter, and you use it whenever when you get to where you're going, or have one at your place where you would naturally go to for an emergency, you would have your water filter. So at any rate, and like I always say, the first thing I would take and put under my arm if I were going to go someplace on an emergency, the first thing I would take would be my water filter, because you're not going to make it far any place without clean water. And so, as I said, the two rules: have a place where you can store your clean water, your filtered water, with sealed caps and containers. And then also, if your water filter or other emergency equipment has an electric cord or any other kind of attachment, then it is not emergency. It's not emergency equipment. I'm not going to do any more product review. I'm just going to send people to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Just go there, let the webpage do the talking, and I'll spend my show time talking about other topics. I just want to comment on something. There's some, as 2012 begins, the clowns coming out of the woodwork are just all over the place. And it doesn't, the people copying my work, the people copying Velikovsky's work, just they're everywhere. There are many, many pages that in many different manners and in different techniques are trying to steal material from other people for their own personal gain. So the rule I always tell people, as you fish around the internet and look for topics and look for experts, look at people's real, I'm not talking about what they pretend to be, because everybody that isn't somebody on the internet wants to pretend they're somebody. Look at their real record, and you'll find that they don't have any. People call themselves physicists that have never taken a physics course. How do you do that? People call themselves, a mythologist or other things like that who have no... All they've done is work in grandma's basement their whole life, and they've never really worked in the field. It's just people, like I say, they live in grandma's basement in some kind of a dream world and pretend they're something they're not. But anybody can have a web page these days. So just buyer beware when you're on the internet, because you're going to find more charlatans and imposters than you can shake a stick at. And their message is really pretty vacuous. A lot of fluff, but no content. That's pretty much what you see. Let's see here now. The main science topic that I want to talk about first, Hale-Bopp versus Comet Lovejoy. And as I explained at the beginning of the show, Hale-Bopp was in the solar system for a period of about 6 years. 6 years. And Hale-Bopp was in the mid-90s. It was still visible back in the as we turned into the year 2000, Hale-Bopp was still visible in the far solar system moving out, whereas Comet Lovejoy and most other comets come in, have a very quick transit, and head out of the solar system and gone, they're gone. What is the difference? How come one is here for 6 years? How come one is here for a couple days and then gone again? Okay, well, here is the situation. Comet Hale-Bopp is in the process of becoming a planet. And very interestingly enough, its orbit brings it in on the same path as Comet Lovejoy. Now, I want to take a simple diversion here for a second, talking about Comet Lovejoy. When it came in, it was very clear that NASA had to have seen this comet. I did a show on that a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I forget. I think it might have been last week that NASA had to see this thing coming. How could they not see this massive comet coming into the solar system? And why wouldn't they want to tell the public? And say, hey, everybody, hey, look out there. There's this comet coming. And it was only visible from the south. So it was mistakenly or accidentally found by a southern astronomer in Australia, who, of course, gets that view of the southern sky. Nobody in the northern hemisphere could have discovered this comet. So anyway, the point is, why would NASA hide the fact that this big comet was coming in and then train its telescopes and then make this public and give this information and their wonderful pictures from their giant telescopes? Why wouldn't NASA make this public? Well, it turns out that Comet Lovejoy had a moon. around it. And the moon you can clearly see on the videos of Comet Lovejoy. When Comet Lovejoy comes in towards the sun, leading it in is another object. And it's a moon that has been orbiting Comet Lovejoy. Well, if you would have looked out into the solar system and seen Comet Lovejoy coming, you would have seen this companion. And you would have seen it orbiting Comet Lovejoy at a pretty good distance, probably about the distance from the sun to Mercury. So for Comet Lovejoy to have this object in tow in an orbit around it was just, first of all, indicates that the nucleus of Comet Lovejoy was big, planet-sized. To give you an idea of this distance, it is many, 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 many times the distance from Earth to our moon. So how does something in outer space keep something orbiting it like that? Well, there's only one solution. Comet Lovejoy had to be massive. Secondly, the orbital period. Amateurs could have easily taken a series of just two or three photos and seen and calculated the orbital period of the moon of Comet Lovejoy. With that simple set of data, then we could have seen and calculated very easily the mass of Comet Lovejoy. So, and that would have proved that exactly how big it was. Like, is it the size of Earth? Is it the size of Mercury? When Comet Lovejoy passed through the solar atmosphere and then came out the other side, you could see the nucleus in the SOHO pictures. So, and then it later, just a little bit after coming back out of the sun, ignites back into a comet. Well, how did this amazing little snowball of 600 feet across survive hours going through the solar atmosphere, passing twice through the solar corona of a couple million degrees, and then come out the other side with all of this ice yet remaining on it? It is so beyond absurd that, fairy tale science, that's all I can tell you. And by the way, the NASA websites that are supported by NASA that talk about these sun-grazing comets, they're supposedly independent, even though they're funded by NASA and government funding. Even though the people claim that they have, down in the fine print at the bottom, they have a disclaimer saying that they're not related to NASA. Their whole job is to defend NASA theories. But at any rate, clearly they didn't want to talk about this, and clearly NASA didn't want anybody to see this coming in. Oddly enough, Comet Hale-Bopp had a companion, and I've talked about that before. And with the data of the orbit of Hale-Bopp, you could have determined the mass of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, showing that it was, in fact, planet-sized. And the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was planet-sized. So anyway, we have two comets that have planet-sized nuclei. And remember, what you see in the comet is, from a distance, that's dust and gas in the coma, the comet tail. And the inner core nucleus is solid. And so you have two comets in recent history, Comet Hale-Bopp and Comet Lovejoy, with nuclei that are the size of planets. Okay, so what's the difference in the transit time through the solar system? Hale-Bopp, which I also said was on the same, coming into the solar system from the same area as Comet Lovejoy, had been here many times before, obviously, and its orbit was around when it first was found, when it was first discovered back in the early 90s by amateurs. Comet Hale-Bopp had a period of around 4,250 years, approximately. Now, that's a very short period comet. Comet Halley, for example, has, I think, a 71-year orbit. So these are comets that are very much in the solar system. Every major planet, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, all have families of comets associated with them that were captured. Standard Science says that these are left over from the formation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago, which is just, again, fairy tale science. There's no proof of that. There's no way anybody could ever prove such a concept. But it's there in all the textbooks, and all of the PhD astronomy students recite it like a nursery rhyme, and that's all it is a Mother Goose fairy tale nursery rhyme. Okay, so at any rate, Hale-Bopp is in the process of becoming a planet. It's during its cycle through the solar system back in the 90s, its orbit was reduced from 4,200 years to 2,600 years. That's because of the tail drag. The tail drag drags on the nucleus, slowing it down, and it drops into a lower orbit with a shorter rotation period, or period of rotation around the sun, orbital period it's called. Whereas Comet Lovejoy was coming in very probably for the very first time. So it was really moving. It was really moving. And Comet Hale-Bopp's orbit, by the way, keeps it out around the orbit of Earth. That's the closest it got to the sun. Was around the same distance from the sun as Earth. In fact, we were almost on a direct collision course with Hale-Bopp when it was first discovered. But the point is understanding orbits. If something's in the solar system, Hale-Bopp, of course, headed out of the solar system around the year 2000, and it'll be back in around 2,500 years. That's a very short period comet. And so its movement through the inner solar system is going to take a lot longer. For example, let's just go through the rotational periods of the various planets. Earth has a rotational period of 365 days. Venus has a rotational period much shorter because it's closer to the sun. Mercury has a rotational period much shorter than that because it's much closer to the sun. Jupiter has a rotational period of about 10 years. So it takes Jupiter about 10 Earth years to go around the sun once. And the farther away you are from the sun, the longer it takes to go around the sun. It's a gravitational effect. It's strictly gravitational effect. The theory of gravitation explains these orbits very nicely. There are some aberrations in that, some very fine-tuning aberrations, some of which are still not understood, especially with comets Neptune and Uranus. But the basic result is the farther away from the sun you are, the slower the object moves. And that's the case with Hale-Bopp. So Hale-Bopp will spend most of its time for the next couple thousand years moving around, coming back, and starting to move back towards the sun. The orbit of Hale-Bopp is perpendicular to the plane of the planets and perpendicular to Earth's orbit. But there is a possibility, and I think NASA probably already knows it, that in a couple thousand years, where will Earth be when Hale-Bopp comes back in? But Hale-Bopp then will change its orbit. It's kind of like a curveball. It's kind of like a celestial curveball, where the comet is changing its properties and orbital properties based on the material in the solar system at that time and the amount of material that's drawn into the nucleus. So that's kind of something we have a hard time predicting because NASA has never studied the effect. We probably know a great deal about this if the scientists had studied my science and accumulated data along these lines over the years. But no, they're still thinking comets are dirty snowballs. And there's no scientific analysis. All of the data that's collected regarding comets is absolutely worthless because the scientists don't know how to study a comet because they don't know what they are. But at any rate, okay, so the comet Lovejoy coming in from the far reaches of the solar system is coming almost directly at the sun. It's like in a free fall towards the sun. So as it gets closer to the sun, it gets past Earth's, the region of space, say the one astronomical unit, the distance from the Earth to the sun, that's a unit of measurement. Once it gets there, okay, the comet is it's really moving along. This comet was moving very fast and came in, flipped around the sun, came out and started to head out of the solar system, and in a couple of days, it's gone. It's heading out, not really visible to the average person with equipment. And then once again, it's heading down out of the solar system, so only people in the southern hemisphere would even get a glimpse of it. And that's part of the solar system that is pointed towards the sun right now. That's why you can't see that part of the solar system. You have to wait till May and June to see that part of the solar system. So possibly by the time May and June comes around, Comet Lovejoy is going to be so far gone out of the solar system that nobody's going to see it at all anymore. What's left of it? Because it's going so fast and going so far, I doubt if anybody will see Comet Lovejoy again. And it's probably slowed down quite a bit, so Comet Lovejoy probably is going to be a permanent member of our solar system. Remember, though, that NASA has equipment in orbit and without the effects of atmosphere, so they can get that data, but once again, they're not going to share that with you, the public. So basically, summary here, the Hale-Bopp was a solar system comet. It's one that's very much associated with the solar system. It's in the process of becoming a planet. And so it has an orbit of around 2,600 years. And so if you look at that orbit, it as it comes through the inner solar system, moving much slower and starting to circularize its orbit, eventually that orbital period will reduce. Probably the next time Hale-Bopp comes through the solar system, it'll reduce from a 2,600-year period to maybe around half of that, around 1,300 years. Then the next time, around 600 years. And then somewhere in there, it could have an encounter, possibly with planet Earth, that would change its orbit and flip it into the solar system or put it into a very different orbit, that would start it migrating into becoming a planet, in which case we could have some serious problems here on planet Earth in the future. Predicting all of that is nearly impossible because it's impossible to determine the orbits that this comet is going to follow or the variable changes due to tail drag. It's pretty much impossible to predict that. As I said, if NASA had been doing their homework and studying these comets like they should have been, we would probably have that data and some inkling of what would happen with Comet Hale-Bopp. But as I said, with Comet Lovejoy, it was into the solar system, through the solar atmosphere, zips around, back out, and probably no one will ever see that in any of our lifetimes, will ever see that comet again. So anyway, to answer the listener question, why Hale-Bopp spent 6 years in the solar system as opposed to Comet Lovejoy, which was only here for a couple of days. Let's take a hypothetical example. A comet comes in, brand new comet, just like Comet Lovejoy. And by the way, this has nothing to do with the mass of the comet. If the comet is heavier, does it move on a different orbit? No, not really. The orbit is mainly dependent on the mass of the sun. If you look at orbital dynamics, once you get to the size of Jupiter, then then it begins to have an effect. But for anything smaller than that, something the size of Comet Lovejoy, something the size of Earth or our moon, typically the mass of the object, let's take an example. Let's take our moon, which is has about 1/6 the surface gravity of Earth. It's a much smaller object. And let's take our moon and send it around the sun in the exact same orbit that Earth is in, but all by itself. Is it going to move in a different orbit? No. It's going to move in the same orbit because the orbit is mainly 99.999% dependent on the mass of the sun. And so it's not dependent on whether Comet Hale-Bopp was bigger or Comet Lovejoy had a bigger nucleus. The orbits of these objects pretty much depends on the mass of the sun. There are other factors. But just the simple answer is that no, the mass of the comet itself, the comet nucleus, is not going to affect its orbit. If it were bigger or smaller, the object would pretty much follow that same orbit. Okay, so that's just some details on orbital dynamics. Now I want to switch gears and talk about the three-blade wind system. Once again, a listener wrote in and asked the question, a listener from England, and said that, you know, they're populating England now with three-blade systems. And I've said it before, this was a planned obsolescence technology. It was understood right from the get-go that these systems, these three-blade systems, wouldn't work. And as the government agencies, which allowed zoning, and as the companies jumped on the bandwagon to build three-blade systems, nobody ever stopped to think of the consequences of putting these all over the landscape, something that really didn't work. One of the other problems with wind power, the way it's implemented today, is that when the wind isn't blowing, you still need the coal, nuclear, or propane-operated generator to generate electricity. And it's very difficult to take a coal-generated plant or a nuclear plant and crank it up to full capacity and then, okay, oh, the wind just started to blow, let's drop capacity down. It's not really the way it works. It could work that way if the system were designed that way from the beginning. But the bottom line is that the three-blade wind generator system just is not going to provide us with the alternative energy necessary to take over the world's energy capacity and systems. As I said on the Coast to Coast show, and I've said on this show, it would take 77 million of the big three-blade systems, these are the 2 megawatt and above, 77 million of those around the world. Just to give you an idea, it would take hundreds of thousands of these around New York City, and a big, just to give you power for New York City. Where would you put these? I mean, they're just the scale, and then look at the expense of building 77 million giant steel towers and then all of the big blades, which, by the way, use petroleum byproducts to build their big fiber, carbon fiber blades, or fiberglass, you might call them. These are giant blades. Look at the resources that it takes to make these blade systems. What's the payback? I've often asked this question. If you had a three-blade system, okay, you put it up, it starts generating electricity. Okay, now let's say you want to pay back the energy that it took to build that tower, the electrical energy to melt down the raw metals, to form it into that shape, to transport it, to put it up. And let's look at all of the components. There's a vast pollution problem with the magnets that are used in the wind generators. They're rare earth elements. Those rare earth elements come from an area of China where it has literally decimated a vast area of China with pollution. The people are dying there because the water is so polluted from the process of removing these rare earth elements that are used in the magnets of the three-blade wind generator system. This does not come at a free price at all. These wind generators are tremendously expensive in many respects, including the environment when they put these together. Now, the public was never told this. All they saw was a nice three-blade system spinning and then the hope in the future, when in the background, the people in control of the energy industry knew all along. They knew from the very get-go that that was a bad design, it wouldn't work. And they could fool the public for 20 to 25 years until this movement went through and they're putting these things all over the place. And at that point, the people finally wake up and they go, hey, these things don't work. They don't produce what they're supposed to produce. They have all kinds of technical problems, and you can only make them up to a certain size. Above that size, they simply will not work at all. because the scale, okay, of the blade system is two-dimensional. As you go to, say, a longer blade, say you double the size of the blade on a three-blade system, then the volume or the area that is swept out by that blade goes up as a factor of four because it's an area. So if you, once again, if you double the length of the blade, then the area of the area swept out by the blades goes up by a factor of four. So if you triple the blade length, now your area is nine times as large. And so the problem here is the scale of the work that has to be done on the gimbals and the support system. So we're dealing with a technology that, as I've said before, really doesn't work. Okay, so enough of that, enough of the negative aspects of this three-blade system. The listener's question was, because, okay, the listener wanted to take a course. Some guy was giving a course on how to build a three-blade system to put up at your own residence to provide your own power. And so the listener's question was, should he take this? I mean, or is there a better design? Is there a better design to put up and implement instead of putting the time and effort taking this course, how to build a three-blade system and put it up, and all the expense of putting it up when it's really a very inefficient system? There are some commercial three-blade systems on the market, and you could pretty much duplicate these with a fairly significant amount of cost. It would probably cost you more to build a three-blade system if you bought all the components. It's kind of like if you built a car. You say, gee, I could use my talents, I could build a car, and it would be a lot. I would save all this money, I wouldn't have to pay the manufacturer of a car. But there's the practicality of making something. But if somebody's giving a course, it's going to teach you how this person giving the course would have already cut the corners and streamlined the process for somebody. I would wonder if you could build something as cheaply and as efficient as you could buy just commercially. But I assume they're using parts like generators from cars, things you can get at the junkyard, and then make your own blade systems, etc. Okay, well, the real question is there a better design out there? One that's much more efficient? And the answer is yes. Where do you get that design? It's not available on the market today. It's not available yet. And so I'm working on getting this design released. It's something that I've worked on for years, but there's a series of steps that have to be performed first in terms of releasing the design to the public. That's all I can say at this point. But let's take a look at a three-blade system. And you can start to imagine what some of the new aspects of a new design would be. If you look at some of the major inefficiencies of the three-blade system, let's take a three-blade system at low wind speed. The blades are barely moving. What's happening to the wind? It's simply blowing through the three-blade system. So one might ask yourself, well, gee, you could build a 20-blade system. Well, there's some problems with that. You're talking about weight. To increase the number of blades tenfold from, say, let's say you put up 30 blades on a single system, the amazing amount of weight in these blades is prohibitive because the axis, the support equipment, the pin that comes out of the motor that has to support these blades is being worked on. Okay, here's another problem. Let me explain one of the major problems with the three-blade system. As it moves faster and faster, as these blades spin faster and faster, they have to bend, they have to pivot on a gimbal, and now the blades are moving into the wind. They're moving very fast, but they're perpendicular to the direction of force. What do you want with your blade system? Well, you want it so that it is, you want the blade system so it's pushing radially around the circle. Okay, you can imagine these blades are moving around basically in the plane of a circle. Okay, so but with the wind, with the three blade system, as they move faster and faster, the direction of the blade starts to become almost in the plane of this circle. So, okay, they have an airfoil on them that gives you lift. Where is that lift directed? Well, it's directed out of the plane of the circle that they're moving in, so they're not really contributing to a force that's in the in, that you need to make the motor or the generator work and produce electricity. Most of the force on the three-blade system on the blades is perpendicular to the plane that you need the force in. So what happens? It starts creating a tremendous torque. The wind typically at the top of your wind tower is less, or it's greater, I should say, than the wind at the bottom blade. So as these blades turn around, the force perpendicular to the plane of the spinning blades, the force is higher in pushing back than the force on the blade that is at the bottom of the cycle spinning around. So what happens as the top blade then spins around to the bottom, the force on it is less than the blade at the top. So you get this pulsating force on the shaft. Just imagine the shaft that's coming out of the generator on the wind generator. You have the electric generator on the housing up there. And just imagine that pin being worked back and forth and back and forth as the blade spins around. Not only does it have to hold the blade up, but it would be like a tire on a car that was not perfectly aligned. And that tire is getting bounced back and forth constantly. It's going to wear out the gimbals and the on the wind system. So at any rate, I'm about out of time here. Just want to remind you to go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and go to the webpage, the sales page, and listen to the archives. All of the radio shows for a long, long time, probably more than a decade, are there. So if you have not listened to many of these, they're all valid today as they were at the time when they were recorded during the live radio session. So once again, this is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.